Wolf of the Plains by Con Iggleden, read by Jason Isaacs. The snow was blinding as the Mongol archers encircled the Tatar raiding party. Each man guided his pony with his knees, standing on the stirrups to fire shaft after shaft with withering accuracy. They were grimly silent, the hooves of their galloping ponies the only sound to challenge the cries of the wounded and the howling wind. The Tatars' horses fell groaning, blood spattering bright from their nostrils. On an outcrop of yellow-grey rock, Yasugei watched the battle, hunched deep into his furs. The wind was a roaring devil on the plain, tearing at wherever his skin had lost its covering of mutton grease. He did not show discomfort. He saw the Tatars rally around a young warrior. The moment had come to ride. His Arban of 9 companions felt it, the best of his tribe, blood brothers and bondsmen. They had earned the precious armor they wore, boiled leather inscribed with a leaping wolf. Yasugei kicked in his heels, and they broke effortlessly into a trot towards the roiling battlefield in the snow. From their height above the fighting, they could all see the full stretch of the wind. Yasugei murmured in awe as he saw the arms of the Sky Father reach around and around the frail warriors in great white scarves, heavy with ice. The Arban moved into a gallop and crashed into the center of the fighting men. Yasugei smiled as his pony hammered into the enemy. The impact broke the back of a Tatar warrior. Yasugei held his mount's mane in one hand, using his sword in single strikes that left dead men falling, using the pony to trample men down. Then he had reached the knotted core of the Tatar resistance, his 9 followers still with him, protecting their Khan. Yasugei was pleased when the young Tatar captain rose in his stirrups and pointed a long red blade at him. There was no fear in the eyes, only anger. Yasugei thought of the sun being born to him over the hills to the east, and wondered if he too would face a grizzled warrior across the length of a sword one day. "What is your name?" Yasugei said. The battle had finished around them, and already his Mongols walked among the corpses, taking anything of use. Yasugei saw a frown pass across the face of his enemy. "What is yours, yak penis?" Yasugei chuckled, but his exposed skin was beginning to ache, and he was tired. They had tracked the raiding party for almost 2 days across his land, going without sleep and surviving on nothing more than a handful of wet milk curd each day. His sword was ready to take another life, and he raised the blade. "It does not matter, boy. Come to me." The Tatar warrior must have seen something in his eyes more certain than an arrow. "My name is Temujin Uje," he said. "My death will be avenged. I am the son of a great house." He dug in his heels, and his mount surged at Yasugei. The Khan's sword whipped through the air in a stroke of perfect economy. The body fell at his feet, and the pony bolted across the battleground. "You are carrion, boy," Yasugei said, "as are all men who steal from my herds." He looked around at his warriors. 47 had left their gear tents to answer his call. They had lost 4 of their brothers against the ferocity of the Tatar raid, but not one of the 20 Tatars would return home. The winter drove men to the edge in all things. "Strip the bodies quickly," Yasugei ordered. "We will camp in the shelter of the rocks." Valuable metal or bows were much prized for trade and to replace broken weapons, but except for the chainmail vest Temujin Uje had worn, the pickings were poor. Yasugei draped the bloody metal garment over his saddle horn. It was of good quality and would stop a dagger's blow at least. He wondered who the young warrior had been to own such a valuable thing, turning his name over in his mind. He shrugged. Despite the cold in his bones, it had been a good day. The storm had not eased by the following morning, when Yasugei and his men returned to the camp. Only the outriders moved lightly, staying alert against sudden attack. The rest were so bundled in furs and weighed down with looted goods that they were shapeless and half-frozen, rimed in dirty ice and grease. The families had chosen their site well. Against the lee of a craggy hill, the Gares almost invisible in the snow. The only light was a dim brightening behind boiling clouds. Yet the returning warriors were spotted by one of the sharp-eyed boys who watched for attack. It lifted Yesuge's heart to hear the piping voices warn of his approach. The women and children of the tribe could hardly be stirring yet, he thought. In such a cold, they dragged themselves from sleep only to light the iron stoves. The time of true rising came an hour or two later, when the great tents of felt and wicker had lost the snap of ice in the air. As the ponies came closer, Yesuge heard a scream from Hoelun's Ger, and his heart beat faster. He had one baby son, but death was always close for the young. A Khan needed as many heirs as his tents could hold. As he vaulted from the saddle, he whispered a prayer for another boy. He pushed open the wooden door and entered his home, the snow on his armor melting instantly and dripping in pools.
"Ha! Get off!"
he said, as his two hounds bounded madly around him. His hawk chirruped a welcome. His first son, Bector, crawled naked in a corner, playing with curds of cheese as hard as stones. All these things Yesuge registered without his eyes leaving the woman on the furs. Hoelun was flushed with the stove's heat, but her eyes were bright in the gold lamplight. Her fine, strong face shone with sweat, and the midwife was fussing with a bundle of cloth, and he knew from Hoelun's smile that he had a second son. "Give him to me," Yesuge ordered. The midwife drew back, her wrinkled mouth puckering in irritation.
"You will crush him with your big hands. Let him take his mother's milk. You can hold him later when he's strong."
Yesuge craned for a sight of the little boy as the midwife laid him down, cleaning the small limbs with a rag. In his furs he loomed over them both, and the child seemed to see him, launching a ferocious bout of squalling. "He knows me," Yesuge said with pride, smiling down at the red-faced infant. Then, without warning, his manner changed, and his arms snapped out to grip the midwife.
"What is that in his hand?"
Under Yesuge's fierce gaze, she opened the infant's hand, revealing a clot of blood the size of an eye. It was black and shone like oil. When Hoelun saw the dark lump, she moaned.
"He holds blood in his right hand," she whispered. "He will walk with death all his life."
Yesuge drew in a sharp breath. It was reckless to invite an evil fate for the boy. He reached for the clot and held it in his own hand.
"He was born with death in his right hand, Hoelun. That is fitting. He is a Khan's son, and death is a companion for him. He will be a great warrior."
He watched as the baby boy was handed over at last to his exhausted mother, suckling ferociously on a nipple. Yesuge's expression was still troubled as he turned to the midwife.
"Throw the bones, old mother. Let us see if this blood means good or evil for the wolves."
His eyes were bleak, and he did not need to say that the child's life depended on the outcome. He was the Khan, and the tribe looked to him for strength. The midwife bowed her head, understanding that something fearful had come into the birthing rituals. She reached into a bag of sheep ankle bones by the stove. Depending on how they fell, they could be named horse, cow, sheep, or yak. The midwife drew back her arm to throw, but again Yesuge restrained her, his sudden clasp making her wince.
"He is my blood, this little warrior," he said,
taking the bones from her. She did not resist, chilled by his cold expression. Even the dogs and hawk had grown still.
Yesuge threw the bones, and the old midwife gasped as they came to rest.
"Aye, four horses is very lucky. He will be a great rider. He will conquer from a horse."
Yesuge nodded fiercely. He wanted to hold up his son to the tribe, and would have if the storm had not raged around the Gare, searching for a way into the warmth. The cold was an enemy, yet it kept the tribe strong. The old did not suffer for long in such bitter winters. The weakling children perished quickly. His son would not be one of those. The boy had gold-colored eyes like his own, almost wolf-yellow in their lightness. Hoelun looked up at the father, his pride easing her worry.
"Have you a name for him?"
the midwife asked Hoelun. Yesuge replied without a hesitation.
My son's name is Temujin, Man of Iron. On a spring day in his 12th year, Temujin raced his four brothers across the steppes in the shadow of the mountain Deliun Boldak. The eldest, Bector, rode a grey mare with skill and concentration, and Temujin matched his pace, waiting for a chance to pass. Behind them came Kassar, whooping wildly. At 10, Kassar was a favourite in the tribe, as light-hearted as Bector was sullen and dark. Kachyun came next in the galloping line, an 8-year-old not given to the openness that made people love Kassar. Of all of them, Kachyun seemed the most secretive. He spoke rarely, though he demonstrated an unusual patience and kindness with Temujin. And Kachyun had a knack with the ponies that few others could match. Temujin kept a close eye on him. Already some way behind his brothers, the smallest and youngest of them could be heard calling plaintively for them to wait. Temujin was a boy with too much love for sweet things and laziness, and it showed in his riding. Temujin grinned at the sight of the chubby boy flapping his arms for more speed. Temujin had barely grown out of the need to be tied to the saddle, but he wailed if they left him behind. Their high voices carried far across the spring grass of the plain. They galloped flat out, with each boy perched like a bird on the ponies' backs. On such a day, the mood of the whole tribe was light. The spring rains had come, and the rivers ran full again. The mares had warm milk for drinking and making into cheese and yogurt. Already the first touches of green were showing through the bones of the hills, and with it came the promise of summer and warm days. It was a gathering year, and before the next winter, the tribes would come together in peace to compete and trade. Yesuge had decreed that this year the families of the wolves would make the trip of more than 1,000 miles to replenish their herds. The prospect of seeing the wrestlers and archers was enough to have the boys on their best behaviour. The racers, though, were what played across their imaginations as they rode. Each of them wanted to race, to make a name for themselves and be honoured. It went unspoken that a boy who returned to his gares with a title such as Master of Horse might one day win their father's position when he retired to tend his herds. It galled Temujin that Bector assumed he would be the one, as if a year or two of age made a difference. Their relationship had become strained ever since Bector had returned from his betrothal year away from the tribe. The older boy had grown in some indefinable way, and though Temujin was still the tallest of the brothers, he had found the new Bector a humourless companion. Bector was already almost the man he would be, with wide, muscular shoulders and immense stamina, and his betrothal year with the Olkunut had given him an aura of worldly knowledge he never failed to exploit. It irritated Temujin like a thorn under his skin. When a young warrior returned from his wife's tribe, he was given the status of a man for the first time. When the girl came into her blood, she would be sent after him with an honour guard to show her value. For the wolves, it was tradition for the young man to challenge his Khan's bondsmen before he was fully accepted as a warrior. Temujin remembered watching in awe as Bector had wrestled 3 bondsmen, one after the other, taking terrible punishment without complaint. Iluk, Yesuge's first warrior, had been the last. The man was like a pony himself, a wall of flat muscle and wide arms. He had thrown Bector so hard that blood had run from one of his ears. But then, to Temujin's surprise, Iluk had helped Bector up and held a cup of hot black arak for him to drink. Temujin had enjoyed witnessing his older brother beaten almost senseless, but he saw, too, that the men no longer scorned him around the fires at night. Bector's courage had won him something important. As a result, he had become a stone in Temujin's path. It was Kassar who saw that Temujin had fallen. Kassar claimed to have the sharpest eyes of the tribe, and he saw that the sprawled speck was not moving. He whistled high-low to Bector and Temujin. Both boys looked round, then reined into a wide circle back the way they had come. Temujin jumped from his saddle as Kassar lifted Temujin into a sitting position. The little boy's face was very pale and bruised. Kachyun slapped him gently, wincing as Temujin's head lolled. "Wake up, little man." But there was no response. Temujin's shadow fell across them, and Kachyun deferred to him immediately. Temujin's deft hands felt Temujin for broken bones. There was a lump on the side of his head, hidden by the black hair. "He's knocked out, but I can't feel a break. Give me water for him," Kassar pulled a leather bottle from a saddle cloth. Temujin dribbled the warm liquid into Temujay's open mouth. "Don't choke him," Bector advised, reminding them he was still mounted, as if he supervised the others. Temujin didn't trouble to reply. He was filled with dread as to what their mother Hoelun would say if Temujay died. They could hardly give her such news while her belly was filled with another child. She was weak from sickness, and the shock and grief might kill her. Yet how could they hide it? She doted on Temujay. Without warning, Temujay choked. Bector made an irritable sound. The rest of them beamed at each other.
"I dreamt of the eagle," Temujay said.
Temujin nodded. "That is a good dream, but you must learn to ride, little man. Our father would be shamed in front of his bondsmen if he heard you had fallen. The sons of Yesuge do not fall."
"I hit my head," Temujay said, dazedly, "and I saw the eagle from the Red Hill."
"There are no eagles on the Red Hill," Kassar replied. "I was trapping marmots there only 10 days ago."
Temujay shrugged. Bector, in the process of turning his pony, looked thoughtfully at the little boy. "When did you see the eagle?"
"Yesterday, circling over the Red Hill."
"You saw a real eagle?" Temujin noticed how Bector had taken a firmer hold on the reins. They all knew how Yesuge dreamed of hunting with an eagle, but sightings were rare, and the nests were usually on cliffs sheer enough and high enough to defeat the most determined climber. Yesuge would be overcome with gratitude to the boy who brought in the calm of birds. Such a gift would be seen as a good omen, strengthening their father's position with the families. Temujay had made it to his feet, touching his head and wincing at the speck of blood that showed on his fingers. Fast as a dog snapping, Temujin leapt for Whitefoot's back, startling the ill-tempered pony into a snorting run. Kachiun flowed onto his horse, with Kassar only an instant behind him, laughing with excitement. In just a few heartbeats, Temujay was left standing alone on the plain, staring bemusedly after the cloud of dust from his brothers.